Good morning. Welcome back, everybody. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're going to talk to folks in Annapolis today. We'll be hitting Scalia tomorrow, by the way, and getting into that pretty intensely. Today, we're going to keep on where we were going since it's a dark day in Annapolis, which means they're not actually in Annapolis. We decided to talk about issues there, especially ones that we have been covering here. We are joined in studio by Delegate Kurt Anderson, Maryland State Delegate, who represents the 43rd District in Baltimore City, is also chair of the Baltimore City Delegation. Delegate Neil Parrott joins us. He's Maryland State Delegate representing District 2A in Washington County. Neil, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, it's wonderful to be on the show again. Thank you.
And Dave Von Love joins us, Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, co-author of the Black Book Reflections from Baltimore's Grassroots. Dave Von, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And Karen York is in the studio with – I'm not in the studio. She's at home. Almost had you in the studio. Senior Policy Advocate for Jobs Opportunity Task Force. Good to have you back, Karen.
Thanks, Mark.
And y'all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Please do. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Comment on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page or send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. 410-319-8888. Before we get into the heart of the conversation, there's one question I just wanted to ask Delegate Anderson – about, and Delegate Parrott can join in, it's not to do with the mainstay of our conversation, which is about the Law Office's Bill of Rights, expungement, other issues that some of our listeners have already written in about in law enforcement. But I'm just curious about what the battle raging is over the appointment of the Baltimore City Liquor Board.
Well, there's always been a battle raging regarding the Baltimore City Liquor Board. It had been one of those, I think it's one of the last bastions of kind of secrecy and
political cronyism, as it were.
Okay, that's the word. And those things die hard. Mm-hmm. And some of the folks have been holding on. We did try to make last year drastic changes in the way the board is appointed and the control that or lack of control that the city has had. Because it's an important position, you know, opening or allowing the opening of liquor stores in neighborhoods.
But there's a specific thing about the appointments that Governor Hogan was making as opposed to the men and women who were sitting on the board before, which often took the community side. People are arguing, and now they're seeing people who are much more pro-liquor store owners on the board. Is that part of the battle, or am I misreading what's going on?
No, exactly. That's exactly part of the battle. One of the things we tried to do in the legislation was to make sure that communities remain very represented on the liquor board so that their interests aren't overridden by those who have money, those who can lobby folks, and I think that's where we're having the problems now.
So we can get into that later in the week. I just want to get your read on that while we're here. I might hit a couple of issues as well. And folks, be careful out there. We're hearing that the roads are very slippery.
But, you know, they weren't that slippery, Mark, that I couldn't make it in here. And I know that, I mean, Neil Parrott, okay, he lives out in Washington County. I get it why he's on the phone. But Karen York, Karen Aslan, she only lives in, like, Roland Park. She could have walked here.
Karen, don't take that from him. Okay.
Mark, I'll handle that with Delegate Anderson once this call ends.
Ooh, look out. 410.
Caller, please be safe out there on the road.
Yeah, please be. It's getting very slippery. Right. And we're actually, 410-319-8888. Let's leap into where we are here, the issues we want to talk about here. I think that ones we've covered a lot on the air before, but I think that they are at the heart of where a lot of people in Baltimore around the state have been since the death of Freddie Gray and the eruptions here in Baltimore, the uprising in Baltimore, and people kind of focusing on the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. So let's talk about where we are with this, because there are many people. There was an entire group that looked at this at this. Mm-hmm. You and State Senator Pugh ran this committee,
right?
And I want to go through the differences between what you're recommending, what Dave Von Love is talking about, and Karen York, and Delegate Parrott. So let me start with you, Kurt. So you had this year-long piece.
Right. The genesis of the work group on police practices and public safety was the fact that many of us had introduced bills in the 2015 session, months before the Freddie Gray situation, trying to change the Law Enforcement Officers' Bill of Rights, trying to make police discipline more transparent. And I think there were like 13 or 14 bills, including some bills on body cameras that were introduced by different legislators. And most of them didn't even get a vote in committee. After the session was over, it was when the Freddie Gray thing came up, and the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate realized that perhaps they'd made a mistake in terms of not allowing, and it wasn't their fault, but not making sure that some of these issues got forward. So they got together and put together this statewide panel that Kathy Pugh, Senator Catherine Pugh and myself chaired. We met for 7 months. We met in different jurisdictions. We met in Western Maryland and Frederick. We met in Eastern Shore. We met in Annapolis. We had a hearing in Baltimore City. We brought in folks not only just from the state of Maryland, but from across the country with regard to best practices on policing. The group was diverse. It was made up of Democrats, Republicans, former police officers, current police officers, state's attorneys, as well as attorneys like myself and folks, all legislators who had nothing to do with the law enforcement. And we came up with 23 different recommendations as a result of it. And some of these recommendations are very sweeping when it comes to what has existed in Maryland law in the past. That bill is now going to make its way to the House Judiciary Committee, the one that includes the 22 recommendations. It's House Bill 1016. The hearing date, I think, is in about 10 days or 2 weeks. And in that bill includes all the recommendations that we made, and that's where the debate now will start. It has the full backing of the Speaker of the House and the President of the Maryland Senate. So there are going to be major changes.
So, Dave, I'm pleased to leap into this. So tell me about your analysis of where this bill is and what you've been pushing for and where you think this is before we turn to Delegate Parrott.
I think the fundamental issue around law enforcement reform has to be about civilian participation in the disciplinary process and administrative process in terms of law enforcement. Because I think it's important for us to understand that in no other major public industry, public safety being a public good, if you think about things like education, there's an expectation that folks who are being served, the people who are being rendered the service, have a substantive role in the way that that particular industry is administered. And what we have in law enforcement, while the 22 or 23 recommendations that Delegate Anderson mentioned, these aren't things that would in and of themselves be bad. You know, one of them is expanding the amount of time that one can file a complaint from 90 days to a year and a day, making it so that you don't have to get a complaint notarized. So these are small kind of Band-Aid things, right? But if you don't address civilian participation and discipline, then essentially what the citizens are left with is being beholden to the goodwill of the industry of law enforcement that's very insular and that don't provide mechanisms where civilians can participate in that administrative process. And so essentially, just to put it even more plainly, we're talking about a situation where police are able to adjudicate and judge other police officers, right? And at the very least, if in the case where civilians are alleged brutality, then it would make sense that civilians are involved in the process. And so this is really the fundamental issue that myself and LBS and other advocates take with House Bill 1016. And just if I can add, I think that it would be a travesty to pass a bill like 1016 as it's written without the elements of amending the LEOBR that includes civilian participation on trial boards and investigation of law enforcement alleged brutality. Because what it would do is it would take all the protests and demonstrations that push the leadership to convene this workforce to produce a piece of legislation that would not substantively include the very people, the very community that fought for law enforcement to be a major issue.
Dave, I'm going to have to agree with you. I'm going to have to disagree very strongly.
I'll let you come back.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We haven't heard from Delegate Parrott. Let me get Delegate Parrott in.
All right, because there's an extreme degree of public participation bill.
Delegate Parrott, then you'll come right back. Delegate Parrott, go ahead.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning.
Yes, well, we're looking forward, and I serve on the Judiciary Committee with Delegate Kurt Anderson, and we're looking forward to hearing the testimony for House Bill 1016. You know, it's important that we consider the police officers and the correctional officers and make sure that they're protected. So we want to have a lot of people still want to get into that profession. It's an important profession, and they need to feel like they are protected if they go into that profession. But also, it needs to be balanced. People who are actually wronged need to be able to have a redress as well, and need to be able to, those police officers that really do act in a wrongful way do need to be punished. And so I'm very much looking forward to hearing the testimony for House Bill 1016 that's going to come up in a week or two, according to what Doug Anderson just spoke about.
So, and let me get Karen, and then we'll come back to all people. I haven't heard of Karen yet. Karen, go ahead.
So, Mark, I actually, the Job Opportunities Task Force is not taking a position on the policing work group, but or the recommendations that came out of the policing work group, but actually have taken strong positions on expungement legislation and policies that seek to provide relief to individuals that have interacted with law enforcement and now have a criminal record as a result and are struggling to secure employment and other critical resources.
So, Kurt, we'll come back to the expungement argument in a minute.
Sure. No, I just wanted to point out that I don't think Davon has characterized the bill the way it actually reads. It's certainly far more than a Band-Aid approach, and it includes enormous, enormous civilian participation. The first thing we're doing is changing the entire Maryland State Police Training Commission, which deals with everything regarding setting up police departments, training police officers, disciplining police officers. It is currently under the Secretary of Public Safety and Corrections. It's going to be a totally different individual department. And currently it has like 19 people on its board. All of those 19 folks are related to law enforcement. They're either police officers, past or present. This new Police Training Standards Board will have at least 5 civilians or up to 7 civilians on the board who have nothing to do with policing. The second thing that we're doing is the trial boards. Currently, in most of the state, all the trial boards are closed to the public. They're like trials. You know, when a police officer gets charged by his department, he can ask for a trial board. Only in Prince George's County and the Maryland State Police have open trial boards. This bill will make trial boards open to any member of the public that wants to come. Third thing, there was a prohibition in the law against having civilians on trial boards, being in judgment of police officers. This bill takes away that prohibition. So there are so many things that I don't understand why Davon doesn't think there's civilian participation.
So let me ask Davon the question. What are we missing in between what you and Kurt are saying?
Absolutely. So, I mean, if we start with the training piece, you know, one of the things that's important to remember about training, that to change the behavior of law enforcement to the community, then people have to be in a position to levy consequences to folks that abuse the community. So, again, like I mentioned before, training might be good, and civilian participation in the training protocols might be good, but that's not the fundamental question of police reform in terms of accountability to citizens. Delegate Anderson mentioned the issue of the trial boards being open to the public. And this is kind of it's really symbolic of what the general issue with this piece of legislation is. Because when we're talking about participation, we're not talking about civilians being spectators at the trial board, right? We're talking about them being involved in the process where they have power to be a part of the decision-making process. And even the part where Delegate Anderson mentions that it strikes the requirement that the trial board be law enforcement, one of the things that, you know, we mentioned is it's important to mandate a civilian to be on the trial board. Federal government, through an agency called COPS, did a bunch of studies around police departments around the country. And one of the things that they recommended to Philadelphia was requiring inclusion of civilians on the trial board. Because if you don't require it, then we all know the way that politics works, where civilians may not be on the board, right, if it isn't required by the particular jurisdiction. And so the argument that I'm making is that if we're serious about substantive police reform, then civilians have to be a part of the process. And just one other thing to one of the things that Delegate Parrott mentioned, you know, in terms of protecting law enforcement. I imagine that there are a lot of good police officers who wish that they could speak out against things that are happening, that wish that they could have more agency to address corruption they see in the department. If civilians are involved in the process, then it takes the pressure off of law enforcement officers within the agency to have to risk their professional career and livelihood in order to root that out. And so we're talking about the importance of having a collective effort with civilians and law enforcement to be a part of administering a service that ultimately it's up to the people to decide whether the service being rendered to them is useful. And so, again, we need to mandate that civilians are on the trial board and that we have to allow non-law enforcement to be a part of the investigation of alleged brutality. If we don't have those two things in the bill, then the other things are Band-Aids. It's cool to have people be able to go to the trial board. You know, it's cool that, you know, people are going to be involved in the training. But the power, the part about shifting power, we're not talking about community police relations. We're talking about shifting power in the hands of the community so that they can have a substantive stake and power in the way the law enforcement administer. And that's the distinction that I'm making between what Doug Anderson is saying and what Doug Carter's bill, HB 760, has in it.
So let me get your thoughts on this, and I'm going to open the phones here, but then I do want to push this question, a couple of issues here before we get into expungement and get into the veto overrides, which we're going to talk about as well. I think that this is where the rubber meets the road for many people who want reform. It's one of the places. So what are your thoughts on that, Delegate Parrott?
On the
having – some people think the only way you can really have oversight in police departments that makes sense is to have a strong civilian review board or civilians participating in decisions, not just police officers.
Well, I think it's interesting that Delegate Anderson's bill is going to allow non-police people to be on that board. And it's also very important, though, that we need to make sure that experts who know how policing works are the ones making the decisions on disciplinary action or not, because they know how the police have been trained. They know how they need to operate and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate, where a civilian doesn't have that training. They wouldn't necessarily know what's really required of the police officers to handle things appropriately in a very tense type of situation.
So, I mean, this is, I think, the part that this and some of the other issues that are coming up about the interrogations and how interrogations are done with police officers. Does a bill change when they'll be suspended for a period, like seeing 10 days until representation is obtained? Is that out or is that in?
Well, it's changed. A police officer who's been notified of charges against him that will be proceeded in a disciplinary fashion within the department has had in the past 10 days before he has to make a statement so he can get an attorney. What we did was we changed that 10 days down to 5 days. We also changed the time in which a private citizen has the ability to file a claim against a police officer for misconduct. Currently, the law is that if something happens that you don't like, you have to file within 90 days. This new law would give you a year and a day to file.
Well, one of the things here, Davon, are there other parts of this bill that you are taking exception to or agree with?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I actually wanted to ask Delegate Anderson is, you know, do you believe that there's a credible argument against the idea of requiring a civilian on the trial board and allowing people outside of law enforcement to investigate issues of brutality?
Well, what we're doing in the bill is to give the police chief or commissioner, who has the power over his own agency, the ability to put on the trial board whoever he wants. It doesn't matter whether, you know, I mean, you're a civilian or a police officer, the person who's in charge of the trial boards, because it's his agency or her agency.
But how does that, just to push a little bit what Devon was saying, how does that change the dynamic? Because some of the people who've been on the show arguing for the reform of this are saying that if you're leaving it up to the police again. There's no civilian oversight. There's no real civilian participation unless it's picked by the police themselves. So how does that change the dynamic at all?
Well, there is civilian oversight because civilians, number one, have not been involved in the trial board. And we're talking about one small part of this bill, the changes to the trial board. But civilians have not been at trial board hearings before, and we decided to open them up to trial board. I mean, the scrutiny of the public is a very powerful thing. It has never happened, and now we're opening up the trial boards to scrutiny by the public.
Second, but scrutiny is different than having participation, right?
Is there a credible argument against requiring civilian participation on the trial board as one of the people that get selected to adjudicate incidences of brutality?
Well, Delegate Parrott mentioned, and I agree with him, that I don't want someone on the trial board that has no idea as to what policing is. In fact, in the bill itself, we've requested that if a person is placed on the trial board, that they have gone through training through the Maryland State Police Standards Commission in terms of it's like putting a civilian to become a judge in criminal court.
Why is it not more like being a judge, being on a jury?
No, it's not being like being on a jury.
If you're given the facts in a case, I'm just taking this argument for a minute. If you're given the facts in a case and your two attorneys are arguing a case and the person on trial happens to be a police officer who's being charged with some misconduct in office, the people on the jury have never been police before, but they're going to judge whether or not this officer, in fact, did something legally wrong and violated his conduct as a police officer.
Yeah.
So why shouldn't – I mean, places like Toronto and other cities around the country here in America have strong civilian review boards. People on those review boards are not police officers. They've never been trained in policing. They make decisions. Why can't the same thing be for Maryland citizens?
Okay. You're actually slightly confusing the issues.
I don't think so.
Okay. Civilian review boards there's a civilian review board that does exist in Baltimore
with
City.
No teeth. You might as well not be there.
Well,
right. And we're talking about the trial board.
That's right. We're talking about trial boards. You're talking about civilian review boards.
I'm talking about both. I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Delegate Oaks has a bill this year to strengthen Baltimore's civilian review board.
Right.
There's a new person who's been put in place to run the civilian review board. She's a former attorney with the Attorney General's office, a young lady by the name of Keisha Brown.
Right.
She suggested changes to put teeth in Baltimore's civilian review board. I get that. But a trial board, unless you've ever sat on one or been to one, the dynamics of the actual members of the trial board is more like a military court martial, as opposed to a criminal jury trial. The trial board, the way it works now is that each member is like a judge. They have to sit in judgment of not only the facts, but the actual application of the law. And you would want to have someone who understands what the law is if they're going to sit in judgment in terms of the application of the law before you put them on that type of board. So that would be the argument against it in terms of requiring anybody to be on the trial board. I would think the person on the trial board would have to be at least qualified as we've stated in the bill.
You were saying what, Davon? Then we're going to open the phones and switch gears here in a moment so we can bring in Karen York and get some other subjects
My only point is that let's say for the sake of argument that it requires that civilian be trained in the way that Delegate Anderson suggested. Again, I don't think there's any credible argument against requiring a civilian to be on the trial board to ensure that civilians are involved in the process. Leaving it purely in the hands of a police chief, right, creates a context where they don't have any real incentive to do it. And we're hoping that if we're serious about transformational change around law enforcement, that we're forceful. You know, Delegate Anderson says it's important to have civilian oversight, particularly in context where it's meaningful and where power is being shared between the agency and the people being served. So I would just think that it would make sense that you would want to mandate that kind of participation to ensure, to provide a safeguard so that local jurisdictions could not circumvent that in cases where it was important that civilians were involved.
Let me get a caller in here very quickly, then go to break. And I do want to come back and talk about these veto overrides and the expungement efforts that are taking place in the House as well and the Senate. 410-319-8888. Ernest, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. I agree with Delegate Anderson. First of all, you have grand juries that don't indict police, they are civilians. You have juries that don't and convict police, they're civilians. I mean, even in the Freddie Gray trial, the first case, the only thing was, did the police render aid? Did the person ask for aid? said he couldn't breathe.
Let's get to the point with this, Ernest. I don't want to get
No, but I'm saying that if you're going to put a civilian on the trial board, it should be a person, a retired judge, or somebody, a retired judge that, or a prosecutor, or that prosecuted police officers that know the system. The other thing is, I think that in this bill, when the police commits excessive force, immediately he should be drug tested, alcohol tested. And also, if they release the record of the suspect or the defendant, they should release the record of the police officer.
Ernest, I appreciate the call, and I think that, I mean, part of it is the reform of the LOBR, the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, LEOBR, excuse me, is more than just the question of civilians on board. So I think that's a really important thing to debate out. It's also all these other issues about how this procedure takes place with police. The many argue the police are treated differently than civilians when it comes to being questioned about wrongdoing on the job. And that's part of what LEOBR was about. We're going to respond to that and come back. Bill, your next caller up. We have Elizabeth, 410-319-8888. Take a short break. Bring Karen back in to talk about expungement and talk a bit about the veto override of the felon's right to vote, all these other issues, and an email coming in about a different criminal justice issue for the two delegates. We'll be back. Try to get through all that. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here with Delegate Kurt Anderson, Chair of the Baltimore City Delegation, represents District 43. Delegate Neil Parrott, who represents District 2A from Washington County, Davon Love, Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and Karen York, Senior Policy Advocate for Job Opportunities Task Force, and you at 410-319-8888. Let's get a call in here. Then I want to switch gears for just a minute and ask a couple of other questions, come back before the end of the hour to the bill we've been talking about, 410-319-8888. Let's go to Bill. You've been waiting for a minute. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Mark. First, let me just say hello to everybody.
Hey, man.
Hello.
Mark,
how you doing?
I agree with Deja and Love. I mean, on two points. One point is that, you know, myself, Eric Easton, all people Congress, a lot of us was very instrumental in even making and helping to create the Civilian Review Board. Once it was created, nobody that pushed for it was a part of it. So, you know, I mean, I do think it's very important that citizens be a part of this whole process. And when people talk about the law, Mark, you know, just like Kirk Anderson knows, it's a lot of citizens out here know the law better than some other police know the law. But it can be a vetting process in terms of how they will pick citizens and how they will put them on the board. We can't say that citizens don't know the law, because some citizens know the law better than some of the police out here. I think part of the problem is this. The more that we keep citizens out, the more we're going to have citizens to rebel and rise up saying we want a true reform. We can't start trying to just have partial reform without going all the way and have total inclusion of the citizenship.
Bill, thank you so much for your thoughts. And let me get another caller in here, then we can kind of wrestle with some of this. 410-319-8888. Elizabeth, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to take exception to that comment regarding public scrutiny giving enough pressure to the police departments to respond properly or correctly with corrective action. I think the fact that there are videotapes, multiple videotapes with police killings will show that has nothing to do with whether or not something is publicly known and how well it may be known. I'm just going to run through a couple of other statements and then get off the air because I would like to listen to the responses. And then I also take exception to the statement regarding, again, civilians not being trained, because police officers don't come to you fully trained. So you have to have a starting point someplace. So start a civilian training program. And if you do feel that the civilians are so unaware of police policy and protocol, then I think you should also start a public campaign to help educate communities. And I don't believe that it's responsible to consider that someone with the authority over a department can select someone outside of the department to oversee their department. That's ridiculous. And I do thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Well, I mean, I agree with her. I mean, I don't think that public should go into this without knowing exactly what's going on. That's why we put into House Bill 1016 procedures by which the public can be trained to participate in civilian review boards. The other thing is
civilian review boards, or the
I'm talking about police trial boards. The one thing you have to understand: there's a police department, and 40 years ago there was no kind of disciplinary process except for what the commissioner decided to do. It was the union, the police union, that got together and forced the legislature to come up with this trial board idea, this Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, totally within the police department. So now instead of the police chief being able to discipline the officer on his own, based upon probably good information, police officers have the right to at least have officers look at what they've done, and those officers make a recommendation to the police commissioner.
So
regardless of what the trial board does, Mark, it's still a recommendation that they make to the police commissioner, whether there's civilians on it or not. And the police commissioner is the one that acts on the trial board's recommendations.
So, Dave, I do want to kind of switch gears here to talk about expungement here and read this email and get Delegate Parrott's thought on this as well. But do you want to have another thought here before we move ahead to a different subject?
I think the issue is that when you talk about what Delegate Anderson just mentioned, that's a question of labor versus management. And I think it's important that we understand that even though it's important to protect employees, it's important for the managers to have the power they need to discipline. If we don't have citizens at the center, and not just in training, not just being able to observe the trial board, not striking the thing that requires it to be law enforcement, but forcefully mandating that civilians are on the trial board, it's the only way that you're going to create a context where it's now common practice that civilians are a part of the process. And until you open that up, then that's not addressing what police reform is. In every other place in the country where there have been investigations of law enforcement officials, you'll find that what is found as best practice is having civilians on these boards of term of discipline. And if we don't require it, then there are going to be mechanisms to circumvent it. Because we see, and even throughout the way in which the FOP has conducted themselves in terms of the trials, in terms of, you know, in the General Assembly, you know, we see that there's an unwillingness to want to bring civilians in a substantive role in doing discipline, which makes sense from a self-interest standpoint, but doesn't make sense from the standpoint of the public good.
So let me and move to Delegate Parrott for a quick thought on this, because I do want to get Karen York back in this conversation. Delegate?
Again, I just think it's important that on the trial board that we have folks who are very familiar with the policing training, so they're the ones who can make those decisions. And I like the thought that we could have civilians on that trial board as long as they've gone through the training and they understand what policing requires. You know, it's interesting in our area, Hagerstown City, they have police training programs where people can, for 6 months, follow police around and get specific training. Even the owner of Chick-fil-A did that out here in Hagerstown. He thought it was extremely beneficial. He learned a lot of things that most people would have no idea that the police need to do. If someone has received that type of training, then to have them on that trial board, I think, could be beneficial.
So let me come back to Karen York here. There's a tweet coming in from Jackie Rabarge. Jackie tweeted in that House Bill 1046, 1046?
1016.
Would be a giant step towards... this is the second email about this. Would be a giant step toward forward on bail reform, which impacts people of color and poor communities disproportionately. So I'm going to come right back to that, Jackie. We have an email about that as well. But Karen, talk about where the expungement issues are.
Yes, thank you so much, Mark. So we've been discussing for the past half an hour interactions on the front end, your initial interaction with law enforcement. But what many folks don't realize is that on the back end, there's something that results from that initial interaction, and that's the criminal record. And so a lot of discussion and efforts have ensued over, you know, the last couple of months and the last year in Maryland around restricting access to the criminal record for purposes of employment and housing and other critical services. Last legislative session in 2015, the Maryland General Assembly adopted a number of initiatives that would both shield certain nonviolent misdemeanor convictions under the Maryland Second Chance Act. Delegate Anderson was the sponsor, and that would allow for the expungement of non-conviction records. And that's the idea where, you know, you have assaults and charges that did not result in a guilty, but you still have a record that's preventing you from accessing employment and the like. So the General Assembly moved to allow access to that. Unfortunately, there are still some limitations in terms of expungement. And so during this legislative session, you'll see a number of proposals that will seek to either clean up the current expungement process or would allow greater access to expungement. So, for instance, Senator Zirkin, chair of the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee, has a bill in that would allow for nonviolent misdemeanor convictions to be eligible for expungement. Right now, only 9 nuisance crimes are eligible for expungement, things like panhandling, public urination. Those are the only things that are eligible for expungement. This would now increase the number of nonviolent misdemeanors that are eligible for expungement. You'll also see an effort by the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Chairman Valerio, to allow probation before judgment to be eligible for expungement, regardless of being subsequently convicted of separate unrelated charges. And then you'll also see a very strong effort to repeal something called the unit rule. And this is something that has come up in the past, but is a very strong tool that's held by many prosecutors. The unit rule, what a unit is a unit of charges, is a number of charges that result from the same incident. And what you'll find is an individual is arrested and charged with a number of offenses. And that individual may plead guilty to one of the offenses out of maybe 4 or 5, and the state's attorney will nullify or drop the other charges. The problem is that the unit rule prohibits expungement of the entire record if all of the charges within that unit is not eligible for expungement. So individuals that are victim of what's a common practice of what many like to call overcharging, they'll have these records where they either didn't do it, they were acquitted, it was dismissed, it was dropped, and yet they can't get that non-conviction off their record because there's a conviction attached to it. So if you're an employer and, you know, you're charged for armed robbery was dropped, but you pled guilty to, say, trespassing, that employer is going to focus on that armed robbery regardless of the final disposition. So this session will be a very strong effort to repeal the unit rule and allow individuals to apply for partial expungement to allow them to expunge eligible charges regardless of whatever is attached to it.
And so before we open the phone tree again, Delegate Parrott, I mean, what you're on the Judiciary Committee, so what's your support of or not on expungement?
Well, I think Karen brought up a really good point about PBJ, that wouldn't be something that people could find out. Because if they've never been convicted of a crime, then why would that be something that's on their permanent record? I think that's a good idea. And I think when we look at expungement in general, I think it is important that many people, the records stay open so that people who are employers, jobs, they would be business friendly so they could say and actually know that person's history. Certain people like churches, they need to know exactly who they're hiring before they put them in sensitive positions or like amusement parks to make sure that they have the right people in the right positions. It's dangerous when we have expungement where these new employers, they don't know what their criminal histories were in certain situations. So I think we got to be very careful what is expunged and what's not. But certainly, again, in the case of PBJ, probation before judgment, if they're not actually convicted, that shouldn't be on that person's permanent record.
I remember my first expungement bill that I got out of committee a couple of years ago. It passed. I finally convinced the House Judiciary Committee to pass this bill allowing expungement of certain crimes, and it was a very close vote. And I think at that time, Delegate Parrott voted against it. It got to the House floor, and it died 69 to 68. What we're doing is trying to make the General Assembly aware, and they're becoming more aware of exactly what it is we're talking about when trying to help those who are reentering society or those who have minor criminal records to help them get jobs, to get housing, to be able to go to school, get loans for school. These kinds of things make a big difference in the overall picture. You know, if people have jobs, they ain't out in the street at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, selling a couple of caps of heroin or, 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 or some marijuana. They want to be part of the American dream. They want to have a house. They want to have a car, an apartment, get married, have kids. And what we're doing is putting these artificial obstacles in front of them by saying, oh, well, 17 years ago, you were convicted of shoplifting, and therefore you can't even apply for this job. Or 10 years ago, you had possession with intent to distribute cocaine when you had maybe you were a user at the time. So all of these things we've been trying to attack in a systematic fashion, and we've gotten the ball rolling far beyond that one day when I lost my bill 69 to 62. We now have members, new folks, even people like Neil Parrott agreeing and understanding that some of this kind of, you know, these changes need to happen.
Karen, quick thought, then we've got to read an email here.
Yeah, I just wanted to interject. You know, Delegate Anderson hit on a couple key points about, you know, ensuring that, you know, expungement and other efforts like this get at really addressing the recidivism rate, of course. But I think we also need to keep in mind that it's very easy to secure a criminal record. So, you know, while, you know, of course, the common record that folks think of is drug possession, you're also finding a lot of individuals, you know, that are struggling to secure employment because they were driving on a suspended license because they didn't realize they had a, you know, a ticket that they didn't pay and their license was suspended and they didn't realize it. And now, you know, they have this record and they didn't know about it until, you know, they went to apply for a job because they didn't spend a day in jail or didn't even have to show up in court. So, you know, whether it's something that happened years ago or whether it's something that happened a couple months ago, I think that, you know, Delegate Parrott hit on a good point as well, that we never want to jeopardize the safety of our workplaces. And we want to make sure that employers are equipped with, you know, all the relevant information that's needed to make the best workforce decisions. But we also have to be careful that we're not disqualifying our best workers or we're not disqualifying someone who could be a great tenant in a housing situation because of something that's totally irrelevant to the job at hand. If you're an employer, you're looking to see if that individual is going to, you know, show up on time and do their job and that, you know, any criminal offenses are not in a direct relation to the job at hand. If you're a landlord, you want to make sure that, you know, they're not going to jeopardize other tenants in your property. But, you know, we have to move away from the idea of thinking that, you know, a criminal record means that you're, you know, a lifelong criminal. Really provide second chances right to those who need it most. And unfortunately, it tends to be people of color that tend to more likely interact with the criminal justice system.
So a quick question here, and then I want to read this email. We won't have much time to discuss this issue. Two people have written in about bail reform. I want to read this out here because that also has to do with criminal justice. But the veto override that took place, very quickly, not that Kurt and Neil, if you want to jump in as well, or Dave on this is fine, but very quickly, your thoughts on the veto override for the right to vote bill for ex-felons.
You know, well, I think first of all, the veto override wasn't for ex-felons, it's for people who are felons.
Right.
They committed a crime, they've served their time in the correctional facility, but they're still on parole or probation.
Right.
You know, for folks that had already completed their sentence, they already had the right to vote in Maryland. We passed that bill several years ago. So what this does is allow people who have not paid their debt back to society to still be allowed to vote while they're on parole or probation. I think it's a big mistake. I think the majority of Marylanders are sincerely opposed to this because they understand that people who are criminals still serving their sentence should not be allowed to vote.
Well, I disagree. Obviously, this was an important piece of legislation that we had fought for. It passed during the 2015 session. Had there been a Democratic governor, it would have become law. The Republican governor decided to veto the bill. And as a result of that, we put in the process what's in the Maryland Constitution, the ability to override the veto if you have a supermajority. In this case, you had to have I don't know if it's two-thirds or three-quarters, whatever the number is. We didn't have the number when the bill first passed in 2015. But as we argued on the House floor during the debate, we actually got more people in support of the bill than who were in support of the bill. And a vast majority of those who represent Marylanders felt that this was an important bill to pass. Look, a guy gets out of jail, he wants to be able to get a job. He wants to be able to feel like he's back, that he's part of society, not being shunned. And one of the most passionate arguments made for that bill was by an ex-felon who was a member of the House of Delegates. So he understood In fact, Corey McRae, it was Corey McRae's bill, Delegate Corey McRae from East Baltimore. And it was funny, when he started to speak, everybody got quiet. You could hear a pin drop. And I think he was very persuasive in getting this bill passed.
Well, and to that point, the citizens of Maryland, Baltimore Sun did a poll, I believe it was like 90% said no, they shouldn't be voting. And unfortunately, what we saw in the House of Delegates, and Delegate Anderson's right, more people voted to override the veto than for the bill. And that's because of highly partisan politics. Speaker Bush got all the Democrats, almost, to vote with him to say, no, we're going to keep this bill, basically to try and make Governor Hogan look bad. I think that's not the way that we should be.
It's not about Governor Hogan, pal. It's not about, it was not about Governor Hogan.
Karen, you were trying to say what?
I just wanted to interject that, you know, while it seemingly came down to Democrats versus Republicans in terms of the veto override, you know, in terms of many of the other second chance initiatives that have to deal with expungement and ensuring access for those that have interacted with the criminal justice system, there actually has been bipartisan support to ensure that we're not disqualifying or shutting folks out of many of these opportunities. So I just wanted to throw that out there, that it's not always, you know, it doesn't always fall along partisan lines on these issues. There actually has been some across-the-line support and coordination for some of these
issues. And if I could say something really quick, just in addition to that, I mean, the importance of the veto override is that there, if we look at the fact that we live in a society structured on racism and white supremacy, you know, folks of color, particularly black folks, are over-incarcerated. We have, you know, more interactions with law enforcement than our proportion to the population. We engage in the same, you know, particularly if we look at drugs, the same amount of drug activity to our proportion in the population. There were 90% of those who are incarcerated for drug offenses. And so if a system is fundamentally unjust in that way, then the veto override, we should look at it as a corrective to the damage society has done to its people. And if it's in the public interest and the public good, then I think the notion of giving, quote, criminals right to vote and participate is something that we should throw out the window if we're really interested in what the public good is, which is giving people who have been systemically undermined in terms of their humanity and full participation in society. If we want to correct that, the veto override was a step in that direction.
You see, I agree with Dave on.
Well, it makes a good point. If that's the case, that people who are being thrown into jail wrongly, then we should just have people who are in jail vote. And really, that's the next vote. I think we should have stopped it here. I don't think people who are still fulfilling their debt to society should be voting. But, you know, that is the argument. Some people are saying, hey, actually, we should bring the polls right on into the correctional office positions. They should go into the prisons. They should be able to vote from there. I just don't agree. I think that people who have committed a crime need to finish their duties to society, finish their sentence, and then be allowed to vote.
But they're out. They're out, and they're now working, and they're taxpayers, and they're contributing back to this. Many of these individuals that was on the front line of restoring this right to vote were individuals that were community leaders. They had been working ever since they had been out. You know, they were leading efforts, you know, in their community and on their workforce. And the only thing that, you know, they felt that was not connecting them to society was this ability to go and vote for who represented them in their community that determined what jobs were coming in their community, what housing policies, you know, were in their community and impacting their neighborhoods and their neighbors. So, you know, I think we also have to be clear about, you know, while they might still have parole or probation obligations while they're out, these are individuals that are giving back. They are already somewhat reintegrated back into society, except for this ability to actually contribute in terms of voting.
So we don't have time to get into this next issue here, but I wanted to read this email, and maybe there's a quick thought from both Kurt and Neil if we have time. But Maurice wrote in, the delegates were interested to hear the delegates talk about modest reforms addressing police misconduct. That's important. But why can't you all talk about bail reform, which continues to be a non-issue despite Governor Martin O'Malley's Commission on Pretrial Justice calling for eliminating bail bondsmen and money bail in its recommendation December 2014. Why did both House and Senate Judiciary Committees both ignore the recommendations? Neither scheduled even a hearing last year or this session to consider the recommendations from this commission. Bondsman and Insurance exercised tremendous political influence in Annapolis. And the delegates understand this issue. They are lawyers. They know that people must pay bondsmen 10% non-refundable fees to gain liberty or remain in jail for 30 or 40 more days. Risk assessment would replace money bail and provide an objective determination for release or jail. Yet risk assessment cuts deeply into bondsmen's profits and legislators' contributions. I think that's the problem.
Well, we've certainly have not ignored the problem. We have been working. I'm a member also of the Maryland Commission on Criminal Sentencing Policy, and we've been working on trying to develop a criminal risk assessment tool that's been verified in other states so that judges and probably even some cases court commissioners would have the ability to take a look at somebody, plug in their information, and then come up with a significant kind of recommendation that would make a determination as to whether that person got out of jail or not.
Our next guest has not arrived yet. Is that right? So if she's not arrived, you guys want to stay around for another 5 or 10 minutes? We can come back to the subject and do the other ones. How many of you can stay for a few more minutes?
Sure, I can.
Sure.
Well, yeah, they're all at home.
Wait, you're here with me. So what, you don't like being with me, Craig?
I love it.
It hurt my feelings.
No. All right, if Neil stays, I'll stay. Wait a minute, is Dave on staying?
Yeah, he said he would stay.
Okay, I'll stay.
So we'll stay, hang out until our next guest arrives. And I want to come back to this subject. It'd be interesting to wrestle with this, how it all fits in the context of criminal justice reform.
Okay.
Stay with us, folks. Don't go away. And the folks who are calling in we didn't get to, now you have a chance to be heard. Stay with us, 410-319-8888. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show. And continue to call in here at 410-319-8888. Want to hear your thoughts and ideas on all the things we've been talking about. Our guests have gratefully decided to remain with us so we can continue these discussions. There's a lot to talk about. Delegate Kurt Anderson, state delegate for represents the 43rd District, is also chair of the Baltimore City delegation. Neil Parrott represents District 2A in Washington County. Davon Love is Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Karen York is Senior Policy Advocate for Jobs Opportunity Task Force. And you at 410-319-8888. Let's go to a phone and then come right back and see what you all think about this bail reform thing that we're called in about. I guess, Karen and Davon, can you weigh in on this as well?
Sure.
All right, good. Well, let's go to the phones. I'll let you guys weigh in. 410-319-8888. Tom in Mount Vernon, you're on the air.
Hi, everybody. I just want to comment on what Kurt Anderson said about employment. I worked in a factory in the 1960s that made bricks down in Brooklyn, in the south part of the city. A lot of men of color worked down there. And some of the fellows had backgrounds that were considered what, ex-felons or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The employer didn't care about that because he had jobs that needed to be filled. So that wasn't a big deal. But now when you've got more workers than there are jobs, employers can be more and more particular about who they hire. It wasn't like that in the 60s. That's all I wanted to say, sir.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Thank you. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Adrian. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you guys doing? I'm really
very
loving
well.
Conversation, Mr. Steiner. I really want to salute you in always having conversations where you bring everybody on board to talk about things strategically in the next step. But, you know, as an observer and being in the NAACP, I want to say thank you to all of the delegates and the Senate for passing a bill on the ex-offender bill. I think this allows and this opens up the door to get more people involved, even with 1610. But this allows everybody to be a part of the process to really start talking about what are the barriers. So if the people that have the most barriers have an opportunity to vote, then they have the actual opportunity now to serve as a constituency to legislators it, whatever way they vote with regards to where the resources are coming. I mean, you have in Baltimore 40,000 new potential registrants to vote for April the 26th, you know, and then you have a Democratic state which showed Governor Hogan that they have the power to veto. So this is a great time in Maryland. I mean, it just shows that everybody is willing to sit down at the table and talk about how we can prevent the situations like the unrest. We can prevent high recidivism numbers. You know, I'm an ex-felon myself, and I've been home for 10 years. I've had the opportunity to advocate in D.C. With Congressman Cummins and Eric Holder on issues of sentencing. And, you know, but all of this is connected, and I just think that this is a great time in Maryland. In fact, we're doing a symposium at my brother's keeper. Currently, I work for the mayor's office, and I work directly with the public, you know, directly with those who can't even meet the minimum threshold to get employment, sustainable employment. So, and now these folks can have a voice. So this is a really great time, and but our event is in March. And Mark, I agree
with the caller that this is a really great time. And here's why. Governor Hogan did veto the felon voting rights bill. We overrode that. But I still believe that Governor Hogan, as well as the Republicans and his the Governor's Office of Crime Control and Prevention, are still a lot more forward-thinking than any other governor that we've had for a while. Here's the reason. 10 years ago, I got a bill passed that it was contentious, but a bill passed that did away with mandatory minimum sentences in drug felony cases. It was contentious. It only won by one or two votes in the House, a few votes in the Senate, and it went to the governor, O'Malley, and he vetoed the bill. Last year, I got the similar bill passed, not quite as strong, but Governor Hogan did not veto it. Now, he didn't sign it, but he did not veto it. This year, Governor Hogan has put together his task force that came up with justice reinvestment, came up with several proposals, one of which was getting rid of some mandatory minimum sentences. So I agree. We're moving in a great direction.
So let me come back to this last tweet and email that came in. And we can go around the room here. I'm just curious before the time we have left, just to kind of wrestle this for a moment. We've covered this a lot for the last 20-some years in the Mark Steiner Show, a lot. Dave on Love, this question that I was reading the letter from Maurice about, the email from Maurice about the Commission on Pretrial Justice. And I want to hear what Kurt and Neil have to say about this too in a moment. Mm. Because it did feel like it was completely ignored after all that commission, all that work. Nobody allowed it to come through. It was killed in committee when they were recommending what basically was the end of the bail bonds industry and a different way of doing things. So what are our thoughts on why this is happening politically and what can be done, if anything? Davon?
Well, I mean, it's important to realize that the criminal justice system as it exists in the way that, you know, black folks and people of color are disproportionately touched by the criminal justice system, a part of the engine of that is the enormous amount of money that is involved in the process. So we're talking about an industry of bail bondsmen, right, that, you know, makes absorbent amounts of money off of the incarceration of particularly of black and brown folks. And just to put it in more perspective, I mean, as a person that works towards social justice, when you think about protesting as an example of, you know, people exercising the First Amendment right, constitutional right to, you know, address government redress. And what you have is an industry where even a part of the expenses that social justice organizations have to incur, right, is looking at bail, which sucks up exorbitant amounts of money to take away from the effort that folks are doing. I mean, one of the things that, you know, during the uprising, I don't know the exact number, but I think we spent about $47,000 of money that was donated from around the country for bail, right, just simply for bail in terms of dealing with protesters. Imagine how that money could have been used in a way that was more effective, you know what I mean, given if this industry of bail bondsmen didn't exist, bail bonds didn't exist. And so I think, again, it's about the fact that money is the engine behind, you know, the way in which the criminal justice system operates. And, you know, the reason why I get the door is because there's a lot of people making money off of it.
So, and before I turn to Delegate Anderson, Delegate Parrott, you're on that committee. I mean, what's the politics of why there was never a follow-up with any hearings after all those recommendations and all that work by that commission?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly the politics behind it, but I can tell you that the current bail system actually works very, very well.
Unless you're poor.
Well, even there, it works well. What needs to happen is people, when they have bail, are able to pay it, and they go to a bail bondsman oftentimes to basically get a rent on that money so they can get out. And then the whole idea is that those folks who are out need to serve their trial. They need to be able to be served trial. If they leave, then the bail bondsman is the one who has to pay the full amount of that money then, or try and find that person and help them to come back. And it's very important that people actually are serving trial who have been accused of something. Whether or not they're guilty or not, they need to serve the trial. And so our current system actually works very, very well. And
The question I have is not whether you believe or don't believe the current system works. I may be one of those who doesn't think it works very well for people. If you're poor and stuck in jail for months and then getting all prost and you still end up with a record, that doesn't make much sense. But the question is why, whether or not, I mean, this commission worked. Had people from there were bail bonds on this commission, there were lawyers in this commission, delegates and senators in this commission, made these deep recommendations after all this testimony, and then completely ignored by the state legislature, completely ignored by the committees you guys sit on.
Well, I don't know that it was completely ignored. I mean, there were certain bills. We did talk about these issues in the judiciary
But they didn't come up. There was no hearing. There were nothing.
I probably would defer to Kurt, because I think Kurt? My recollection is that we did hear some things on this, but Delegate Anderson?
Well, look, we have been working on bail issues for a long time. Be perfectly frank, I don't remember the reason why we didn't put this bill to a vote. There's a lot of consideration that has to go on in terms of figuring out how to make this work. If you don't have a bail system, then here's the system that you have. A judge decides whether you stay in jail or you get out before your trial, period. Okay? There's no gray area. There's no bail. He just decides you're too much of a danger to society, or we think you're going to recommit the crime, or you're a danger to the person who's accused of this. So you don't get out of jail, period, or you stay in jail. There's got to be a gradation somewhere in the middle that allows there to be a system where the person who is innocent until proven guilty does get out of jail, even though he's charged with a fairly serious crime.
Well, that's why they have this thing that in other states, Kentucky places, one of the few things Kentucky does that's progressive. It's a risk assessment instead
risk
of bail.
Tool.
Right? And that lets people, like a majority of people in Baltimore City get arrested for these small crimes, have to sit in jail for months waiting to get out and then lose their jobs, lose their homes, family issues erupt. I mean,
we are working on putting a risk assessment tool in place. I forgot which county is doing the pilot program now. The Criminal Sentencing Guidelines Commission is also working on the risk assessment tool. It's not something that's going to change tomorrow or overnight. Now, I know everybody wants it to change right away, but what we need to do in the meantime is to have probably a specific bail amount set for specific crimes with specific persons who have specific backgrounds, as opposed to judges giving disparate bails all over the region.
So we'll come back to this for a longer conversation than for an entire hour. But I, Karen, I don't know if you want to weigh on this at all, not before we come back to kind of expungement some of the issues before we run out, before we move to our next segment.
Nope, I'm good.
She's honest.
She is that.
Yeah.
So
I would like to make one comment. You know, Tom, one of the callers earlier, he talked about jobs in the 60s and how we don't have the same opportunities that we have today. And that's a big problem, and we need to try and get more jobs and businesses to come to Maryland. And that's one reason why I'm really excited about the manufacturing tax credit that's going to be offered, hopefully. It's in the Governor Hogan's budget. Hopefully it's passed by the legislature. But in the city of Baltimore and Western Maryland and Eastern Shore, areas where it's a depressed economic environment, and try and bring some more manufacturing jobs to the area to help with these jobs, it helps all the way around. Once people are working, less crimes are committed, a more opportunity for everybody. So I agree with what Tom was saying. We need to get back to where we were in the 60s, where jobs were more plentiful than they are now.
So where is this expungement bill going to go?
I'm sorry, Mark?
Where is expungement going?
Well, there's several expungement bills being considered. Now, Delegate Carter has a couple of them. Delegate Barron from Prince George's County has one, at least. I know I have a couple. They all are going to be in the House Judiciary Committee or the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee.
They're going to be heard in the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee on February 24th and in the House Judiciary Committee on March 8th. March 8th is also reentry day in Annapolis for those that are interested in coming to Annapolis to testify in support of expungement legislation, but to also talk to lawmakers about support for different proposals that would allow individuals with records to better reintegrate into society. Politically, as I mentioned last session, we saw a lot of bipartisan support for restricting public access to the criminal records, specifically, for the purposes of the employment argument. I don't think that any of that political support has dwindled. On the national scene, you see that, this continues to be an hot issue and an important issue, and I don't think there's any different in Maryland. It seems that Governor Hogan continues to be committed to supporting efforts that would remove employment barriers for all Maryland workers, specifically those that are facing a number of barriers, and we hope to continue working with his office to educate him and his folks on these issues and to secure their support, in addition to committee members and other policymakers. Because, let's be honest, before it gets to the governor's office, we got to get it out of committee and we got to get it off the floor.
Let me get a caller in here and let the delegates respond and Dave on as well at 410-319-8888. Sheldon, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, I've had a violent crime. Actually, I'm a prime example of what y'all are talking about. And I went to file for a motion to have it expunged from my record, but I went to court and the judge said I would need a lawyer. And I asked him, can you explain why I need a lawyer? So I could just file for whatever the motion a lawyer could. So he just didn't explain to me, said he needed a lawyer. The other thing I wanted to make a statement on was also that the listeners might want to know that I was arrested again by a police officer who actually came to my house for a domestic dispute, and he arrested me and charged me with assaulting a police officer, failure to obey the instruction of the law. Anyway, I was released, and I went straight to the police district and pressed charges on him. By the time I got my lawyer, we went to court. Well, they wanted to dismiss the charges on me and wanted me to also drop the charges on that officer. And right there, I didn't understand what was going on at the time, but I realized that because the officer was wrong is why they dismissed the charges and dropped the charge on him, because they didn't want to prosecute me because they thought I had a long rap sheet, which I didn't. And so my lawyer said it's best to just drop the charges because he ain't going to pursue the charges on me.
Yeah, well, your lawyer was being lazy. He basically, saw an opportunity for your charges to get dropped and therefore tried to persuade you to drop your charges against the officer. If you were adamant about it, I think you could have forced your attorney to say, look, let him drop the charges against me, but the man was wrong and I'm going to continue against him. You have to be, you have to be strong, even despite the fact that the person you're paying is giving you advice in the other direction. You know that they didn't have anything on you. So you could have gone and said, look, let's throw down. I'm ready to roll dice right here because they can't find me guilty on this. He don't have no witnesses, but I know what he did to me. Now, I'm a lawyer, and I can tell you that I've seen lawyers do this. They get the police to drop the charges. If you drop the charges, nah. If they're wrong, they're wrong, and you should go forward with it.
Jackie just tweeted in, taking away voting rights should never be a punishment.
Well, if you're locked up, I think it is a punishment. I mean, you can't vote in jail. There's no doubt about it. You suffer when you commit a felony and you're found guilty. There are things that you have. You lose you lose a lot of freedoms, not just your voting right freedom, but you lose a lot of freedoms.
It's true. I mean, I think Maine may be the only state is one of the states where you're allowed to vote while you're in prison.
Okay, who's from Maine that you know?
I know lots of people in Maine.
Oh, okay. Hey, can I plug something real quick, Mark? Tomorrow.
And if I said no, what? You would do it anyway, right?
No. It's your show. this is your show.
Kidding.
I respect you, man.
Go ahead.
Anyway, tomorrow I have a hearing in Annapolis on a bill that would reimburse people who have had the police come and wreck their homes only to find it was the wrong address, or police who have searched their car and don't find nothing but pull out all this, you know, all the stuffings on your car. Right now, you go through a lot of red tape if you can get your money back at all. And what I want to do is to set up a situation where the jurisdiction where the police officers are have an automatic plan to reimburse you when this happens. And the hearing's tomorrow in Annapolis at 1:30. You can email me if you can't make it and just send me a little blurb. And it's kurt.anderson.house.
No, kurt.anderson@house.state.md.us.
What she said. Yes.
You know, I haven't seen that bill, but I have seen a lot of the effects of, like, no-knock search warrants. They bust down the door.
Right.
They go sack the house looking for stuff, and then they leave, and the whole bill is left to the person in the house. That's just not right. So I'm encouraged to see what you have tomorrow, Kurt.
Okay, thanks, Neil. And that's what I'm saying.
Across the aisle.
It's not just Neil Parent. There are many Republicans across the aisle, like Senator Huff from – where's Huff from, Neil?
He's from Frederick County.
He's in Frederick County. Senator Shankman, he was in the legislature. There are a lot of guys who understand what's going on. And, you know, if we can just work together, I do stuff that they want me to do sometimes.
He said sometimes.
Shouldn't have said that on the air, but.
No. That's part of the issue people are wrestling
but
with.
But it's part of reaching across the aisle, working together.
We do have a message here saying, why shouldn't you be able to vote if you're in jail? Because they count those bodies in states and state voting rolls, but they don't let people vote.
Well, they are counted in the U.S. Census every 10 years. And it's interesting, too. We have big correctional facilities here in Washington County, three large ones, actually.
Yeah, you do.
And just recently, they said that we're not going to count them from Washington County. We're actually going to count them from where they came from, you know, whether the Howard County or the city of Baltimore or wherever. So they're actually not counted here, but they're counted in the jurisdiction where they came from, which would make sense that when they go back and they get the right to vote back, that's where they are, instead of voting actually from the correctional facility here in Washington County.
Yeah, but the email or the tweet you just got said that they should be able to vote while they're in prison?
Yes.
All right. That's way, way, way too far.
Dave,
a guy carjacked my car is going to be voting in the next election? I don't think so.
Davon, you want to weigh in on any of this before we run out of time?
I mean, all I would say is that I think if we look at mass incarceration and we look at the fact that, you know, there are a lot of folks that are in prison, not necessarily for carjacking, but in prison because of the way the criminal justice system disproportionately affects us. So I think it is worth serious consideration in terms of looking at ways to create more participation of folks in the process. It's one thing to do something that's problematic and harmful to the public and be given those kinds of rights. It's another thing, though, when there are large swaths of people. And that's the reason why we had the veto override. That's why we have the expungement bill, because there are lots of people that are caught up in the criminal justice system in ways that are unjust, and there are a lot of people who are excluded from the democratic process as a result. So it's worth thinking about. It's worth thinking about how do we include more people in the process who've been unjustly disenfranchised.
I mean, that is going to be, I think, a huge topic of conversation going forward. And let's get to a couple of phone calls in here before we run out of time completely. And I do appreciate everybody staying with me here this next 20 minutes. We're almost done here. 410-319-8888. Theodore, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Good morning. How
good morning.
Are you all?
Very well, Theodore. Welcome.
So Mr. Anderson, that was a pretty nasty comment the governor made when he predicted that a lot of people would lose their seats. I think when we look at the next governor's election, do you think his prediction of dire consequences could be reflected, hopefully, in his own political demise in the next gubernatorial election? And do you think there are some viable candidates statewide out there who could help the governor go back to his business and become a better citizen than he is in the governor's house? Do you think that's possible?
Well, I think it is possible if we have a much better turnout than we had in the last election. I believe the reason that Anthony Brown lost for a couple of reasons, but one of them was that the turnout in the areas where he was expecting to win was not very high, especially here in Baltimore City. Even in Prince George's County, his home district, had the turnout been, if had people been excited about his candidacy, and I'm not saying, well, I am saying that some folks were apathetic, but this next election really depends on, I think, who the candidate is. It could be an Ike Leggett, who is the Montgomery County executive, who's term limited. It could be Rashern Baker, who is the Prince George's County executive, who's also going to be term limited. It could even be Kevin Kamenetz in Baltimore County. Are these names that you've heard of? Probably not most people. Would they excite you? Well, they excited folks enough to get elected in their counties. But I think the turnout really depends upon how dynamic the candidate is, how charismatic he or she is, and how he or she gets to the voter. It really all depends upon the candidate and then the turnout.
Yeah, and I'd like to speak to that as well. I mean, Theodore brings up a good question of governor politics in the next 2 years. We're going to have that election. You know, we see Governor Hogan's approval rating at 60% plus right now, and part of that's because he's not leaving any part of Maryland behind. He's really looking to the city of Baltimore, trying to get jobs coming back to the city, trying to get businesses to work. We've added over 53,000 jobs in just the last year. We were one of the lowest in the country. Now we're moving right back up. If we continue to see positive changes, I'm very hopeful that Governor Hogan will see another 4 years, because the people of Maryland will say, hey, we're making positive changes. People are getting jobs. We're in a different position than we were 4 years ago. And as we look at that, you know, even 2 years, this coming November, we're looking at the U.S. Senate race. And we've got a bunch of really good candidates all across the state. But, you know, Kathy Schlage is one that I think is going to be very good.
Okay, can we stop the Republican commercial now?
No, but you had a Democratic commercial. He has the right to have a Republican
commercial. I'm just saying, Baltimore City has not been left behind. I guess if you say it over and over again, maybe some folks would believe it, but that's not where Mr. Parrott and I agree.
We could probably keep this going for the next half an hour, but we can't.
I am obligated to at least step in and...
Okay,
you got to take a break. I understand that.
Delicate Ernest.
But I have a higher obligation.
I thank you so much for being with the city, Kurt. It's always great to have you in the studio. I appreciate you staying this extra time. Same with Neil Parra. Thank you so much for being
thank
with
you.
Us. Dave Onlove and Karen York, thank you both so much also for giving
us
the extra time this morning. It meant a lot. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Have a good one.
We are going to take a short break, and on the way to break, I'm going to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn more about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. We'll be right back with an interesting interview with Michelle Alexander. Stay with us.